It's no exaggeration that in the past couple of years, the go-to resource on the multifaceted intersection between religion, politics, and culture in our nation, again and again, has been Religion News Service national reporter Jack Jenkins. A knowledgeable and objective reporter, a prolific social media commentator, and an always welcome guest on this show, Jack has just published his first book titled American Prophets, The Religious Roots of Progressive Politics and the Ongoing Fight for the Soul of the Country. Now, we made Jack promise to be with us the week the book hit the shelves, and true to his word, here he is. Jack Jenkins, congratulations, and welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
The premise that a political religious right spawned as a so-called moral majority a few decades ago would remain forever dominant in our culture is a common one. Interfaith Alliance itself was born as a constitution-based response to those theocratic impulses. Your narrative identifies Charlottesville 2017 as a turning point. Why?
So one of the interesting things that happened in Charlottesville, and there was a lot of coverage of what happened the day of the big Unite the Right rally, where a lot of white supremacists and, you know, Nazi sympathizers gathered in that city, ostensibly to defend a Robert E. Lee statue, but when, you know, often it has since become understood to be a true white supremacist rally. And a lot of coverage came out of that encounter between these scuffles between white supremacists and some kind of hard left activists and Antifa organizers, anti-fascist organizers. But there was also this entirely different wing of counter-protesters against those white supremacist activists. And those were faith leaders and people of faith. And what many folks don't know is that the night before, you actually had this gathering of religious leaders in a church right across the street from the university there in the town, that was kind of this, you know, beginning rally, this sort of religious rally to gear up for counter protests that would happen the next day. And as people were gathering in that church, and as Reverend Tracy Blackman, a pastor out of Florissant, Missouri, who was really involved in the Ferguson demonstrations there years before, as she was preaching, a group of white supremacists descended on the university across the street with tiki torches, shouting racist and anti-Semitic slogans. And so suddenly, you know, these people who were in this church had to close the doors and kind of wait out the white supremacists who were, you know, very close to them. And apparently there are reports that there was actually one white supremacist in the church with them who was live streaming their church service back to their followers. And so what ended up happening was that collection of white supremacists really kind of galvanized a lot of different religious left leaders and kind of these more progressive faith-based organizations and who had these representatives in Charlottesville. And the next day you actually had a group of them stare down white supremacists and, you know, like form a line trying to prevent white supremacists from entering the park. And so they played a deep role in that day. But if you telescope out, one of the things you see is that that was kind of the result of years of organizing among progressive faith groups around the issue of racial justice, and then actually a lot of other issues as well. And so it kind of became this unsung moment of solidarity among religious left organizations that sometimes operate with different agendas, kind of coming together for one common cause. And that became a repeated refrain throughout the Trump administration, that these disparate progressive faith communities and activist groups and campaigns that had, you know, fought to, you know, combat climate change and fought to protect the rights of immigrants and protect the rights of LGBTQ people, all these faith-based organizers suddenly had a common cause, which was to push back, to resist the administration of Donald Trump and some of his supporters, which included some of those who are marching through the streets of Charlottesville. And so one of the things I trace in my book is, you know, that story, as well as many others, of how these groups had spent years organizing and kind of found a really big moment of activism and a common cause in the Trump era.
You know, many of us feel frustration that the momentum never seems to change, regardless of what happens in politics or in public religion. But you seem to be saying the momentum actually has shifted for many Americans who were horrified by the events we saw play out in Virginia. Is that right?
Yes, and I think, you know, there's a couple different things happening there at once. One of them is that the religious left never went away. Progressive faith communities who would be seen as the antithesis to the religious right have continued to organize and actually play a prominent role in American politics throughout the last couple of decades. A lot of their work has just kind of gone unnoticed. For instance, you know, one of the first chapters of my book, I trace how progressive faith communities actually played a very crucial role in helping getting the Affordable Care Act passed under Barack Obama. In fact, Barack Obama himself has said it wouldn't have gotten passed without the activism of Catholic nuns in particular. And so you have this sort of, you know, already stable apparatus of progressive faith organizations that have been operating for some years. But one of the interesting things that has happened under the Trump era is that the religious right in particular has kind of had this moment where even members of conservative faith groups, conservative Christians, are starting to have these deep abiding frustrations with these religious right figures as they, you know, continue to attach themselves to Donald Trump in ways that they find actually kind of, you know, conflict with their own faith. So enter the religious left, which had already existed and continued to organize, and suddenly there's something of a, you know, from their perspective, a moral vacuum that has occurred. And so they're kind of occupying that space in the public sphere. And then in addition to that, because there's this outcry within progressive circles against the Trump administration, if there had been tension between the religious and non-religious in the broader progressive coalition, a lot of that has been diluted because the progressive faith communities have been at the front of so many of these activist demonstrations and marches. And so it, you know, two things are happening at once here, where one, the religious right seems to be having a pretty tough time maintaining the same moral credibility that they've tried to hold on to for decades, whereas the religious left is out in front, you know, championing a very specific moral voice, whether that's, you know, Reverend William Barber or someone like Tracy Blackman or indigenous activists fighting for the climate. You know, take your pick. There's all these different activists that are taking up the media space and the moral space that the religious right used to occupy.
I want you to say a little bit more about how this change is playing out, because I think there are a lot of people who would say to us, we don't see much change. It's all about the religious right.
Well, I mean, I think one of the realities is that, you know, the Trump administration remains in power, right?
Yes.
And so while they remain in power, it's difficult to see the change because change in our country happens during elections. Now, there's a few examples that might point to a resurgent progressive faith space and just change in general happening all at the same time. So, for instance, the election of Doug Jones in the state of Alabama to be a Democratic, one of the first Democratic senators in that state in quite some time, over against Roy Moore is an interesting test case. Now, granted, Roy Moore was a uniquely flawed candidate for the Republicans. He, you know, also was dogged by allegations of sexually assaulting children. So he had a lot of things that, you know, made him uniquely difficult uniquely unelectable. And yet, on election day in Alabama, you saw, you know, the demographic that really showed up for Doug Jones and helped, you know, put him into power were Black Protestants in particular, particularly women who make up a disproportionate percentage of the pews in Black churches. And those were organized by a lot of Black churches in their get out the vote efforts. Meanwhile, before that, back in 2016, when Trump was elected, which was a pretty dark day for a lot of Democrats, the one bright spot for Democrats was the unseating of a Republican governor in the state of North Carolina. And many analysts attribute that to the Moral Mondays movement, which was this actually one of the largest liberal movements of the decade, this sustained protest movement run by Reverend William Barber, who was head of the NAACP in North Carolina at the time, decrying what they saw to be a very draconian and regressive conservative state legislator and governor. And so unseating those seats of power, people credit that to religious left activists. And even during the Trump administration, when he one of the biggest media scandals that he had had was the implementation of the family separation policy of immigrant families along the U.S.-Mexico border in particular. And the pushback to that policy was so overwhelming and rooted so much in the faith space that it ended up with, causing the administration so much consternation that, Jeff Sessions eventually was removed from his position as Attorney General, and many people attribute it to the fallout around that decision, around that policy, and progressive faith communities played a big role in the counter demonstrations against that. And so, again, until there's a massive change in power, sometimes it's difficult to see how the pieces on the chessboard are moving. But, there's definitely indications that within the broader progressive coalition, you're starting to see progressive faith groups have an impact and take a leading role in a lot of the activism that's coming out of liberal circles.
Yeah. What sets apart the leaders that you focus on in your book, other than the fact that almost all have been on State of Belief a number of times? why did you choose these particular individuals?
So this is a good question. It's an interesting one to try to tangle with in the book. So I kind of separated out often into specific campaigns and stories, right? So, I have an entire chapter looking at the intersection of indigenous environmental activism and Pope Francis's role in environmental activism, kind of pointing out how those two, Pope Francis writing an encyclical on protecting the environment and indigenous activists in Standing Rock and Hawaii, advocating for what they believe to be sacred land, how those have actually had a big impact on the environmental movement writ large, and actually apparently played a role in why Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, later the architect of what we now call the Green New Deal, why she ran for office to begin with, is that she argues she had a spiritual experience in Standing Rock. And so I say that because this book it would be impossible to do a complete total history of all of the boundaries of the religious left. So what I narrowed in on for this project was looking at where are the movements and who are the leaders who have had the biggest impact in politics, in the larger progressive activism space over the last 15, 20 years. And so I didn't get all of them in there, but for all the chapters, I tried to show how these are where they're making a difference. And these are faith-based activists, some of whom have been around for a while and some of whom are relatively new and you may not have heard of until you read the book. So that was kind of my guiding light, was where can I find the spectrum of influence? And not all of them have influence for the best reasons, right? Like sometimes activism is successful because they have the ear of the powerful, and other people would also like to have that ear. But, when you're talking about politics and you're talking about shifting from the way that it is to the way that it could be, that's a key thing to pay attention to. And that's what I was paying attention to as a reporter.
Jack, reading your book made me think of numerous entries in the diary I kept during those days. I remember an afternoon at the Center for American Progress when we pretty much decided to form a new religiously oriented entity. Right after that, I walked over one morning to visit with John Podesta. And as I walked in his office, he was smiling. I wanted to say to him that Interfaith Alliance would be open to helping form the kind of entity that we had talked about. And John said, "I knew that you would be coming in. Jim Wallace has already been here. Wallace is too," he said, "Wallace is too conservative and you're too liberal."
Wow. Should have interviewed you for that chapter of the book.
No,
That's an amazing story.
now the reason I thought about that particular experience was because I know that you dealt with this in writing the book. There was a lot of resistance among some people of using the term new religious left. And yet that sure does seem to be what we're talking about here. So do you hear objections to that now? And if so, what should we consider in choosing language to discuss the movement that you write about?
And I think this is an important question, and it's something I address kind of in my introduction. Many of the people I profile in the book actively reject the term religious left. Interestingly, they have different reasons for rejecting that term. Some reject it because they see it as too constricting, right? William Barber has this line where he refers to the religious left as, quote, too puny. It doesn't quite encapsulate what he argues is the broader implications and the broader efforts of his campaigns and activism. Others think it's incorrect. So there are some people for whom the term left has a very specific political meaning that is often associated with, old school progressivism, sometimes democratic socialism. And so some people who might be labeled religious left, they think would be, liberal sellouts and not as progressive as they are. And still others don't like the association with the religious right. They don't see themselves as they don't want to be a mirror image of this thing that they, kind of feel like they're combating. And the truth is they're not. I mean, in my reporting, the religious left is organized and functions very differently from the religious right. However, it has been interesting to see how many people have started using that term to self-identify. For instance, Linda Sarsour, who's one of the people I identify in the book, actually identifies as religious left. And of course, over the course of this last Democratic primary, we had candidates like Pete Buttigieg who openly talked about the religious left and used that phrase. And so I don't think you're going to find an agreed upon term for, that everyone kind of agrees to within the religious left for what they should be referred to as. And I think that's actually kind of one of the things I talk about is that one of the greatest indicators of belonging to this community, whatever you call it, is not always agreeing on what you should call it. That debate is like central to what happens in this activism space. And it's part of the reason I called the book American Prophets, because, this is, I didn't call it like American policy wonks. I didn't call it, American, institutional politicians, because a lot of these activists and these advocates see themselves as these kind of, not themselves as prophets, but operating in what's called the prophetic tradition, as one who critiques those in power, irrespective of party or affiliation, and wanting to represent the least of these. And if that's your motivating factor, if that's your core position, then, you're going to resist specific labels that could tie you to one party or organization. So I use the term religious left, knowing that a lot of people might not like it. But, if somebody finds a better term, I'm all up for it. But I don't think you're going to find one that people agree upon.
Well, often it strikes me that we might ought to just go with American profits and leave it at that. But
Fair enough.
either way, what values and priorities do these leaders and their supporters share that sets them apart?
I do. Well, one, they're uniformly the leaders themselves, as it were, almost uniformly people of faith. And in addition to that, they definitely, there's a pantheon of different religious communities and represented in the religious left. And I want to be clear about that, because in this modern era, interfaith elements, interfaith activism is actually a key component of the religious left. It part of its strength is drawn from the fact that it gets Sikhs and Buddhists and Muslims and Christians and Jews all in the same room to advocate for the same causes. But and so you're going to have people articulate different religious reasons for why they are there, right? So, for instance, why when a Christian might refer to protecting the least of these, a Jewish individual or a Buddhist individual might have a different scripture or an axiom that they'll reference. But what you still get is this consistent respect for the poor, those who are imprisoned, the immigrant, and those who are left out of society. It is a group of people who are far more concerned with those who are not in positions of power than those who are in positions of power. Their core animating force isn't to protect the powerful. It's to lift up those who are powerless. Mm-hmm. And that's a little different than you're going to find in some religious right circles, who are often defending those who are, you know, already in power, who already have money and influence. The religious left, more often than not, you know, reflexively will defer to those who have been outside of the system. So that creates a really unusual and interesting dynamic between the religious left as an activist force and the elements of the religious left that are running for office. And I think this past election cycle was fascinating because you had these moments where people like William Barber and Reverend Liz Theo Harris, the co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, had a presidential candidates forum here in Washington, D.C. And they had 9 candidates show up, which is remarkable when you consider that Netroots, an established progressive entity and gathering, just a few weeks later when they had a candidates forum, they only got 4. And what happened at that candidates forum that Barber and Theo Harris put on was you had people like Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris and taken to task, basically ask really pointed and direct questions about what they're going to do for the poor, what they're going to do to fight against climate change, what they're going to do for the immigrant. And so it's even among those candidates that you would expect people in this circle to support, they're still, you know, their main core focus is on those who are underrepresented and who are left out. So that to me is often the kind of the if there is a common ethic, a common pan theology, as it were, it's a respect for the least of these, not just in a Christian context, but those who are left out of the system.
In your reporting, do you see secular Americans recognizing the religious component of this movement? And if so, do you think it's more of an attraction or a turnoff?
So this is an interesting question, and I think it's something that's changed over the course of the Trump era. When I first started reporting on the religious left, you absolutely saw points of tension between, you know, kind of more passionately atheist and agnostic people, or people who were just religiously unaffiliated or even attached to religion who just really didn't like seeing, religion preached from a podium, a presidential podium. They just really didn't like any fusion of faith in politics. But what has been interesting, and I talk about this a little bit in some of the chapters in the book, some of these activists have kind of earned credibility within the broader progressive coalition, parts of the Democratic Party who might have been uncomfortable with people of faith occupying prominent positions and, you know, being on in big and important stages in the past. You know, when the people who were at the front of these protests to protect the Affordable Care Act, when Republicans wanted to repeal and replace it in the early era of Trump's presidency, you know, it was people of faith. It was religious activists who were organizing a lot of those protests. You know, when there was the initial response to Trump's inauguration, the Women's March, one of the 4 co-chairs of that march was Linda Sarsour, who self-identifies as a religious left activist. And these cases kept repeating to the point where, you know, while there may have been some tension, and there may still be some tension between those who want a more secular vision for American progressivism and, you know, those who come to it from a religious perspective, I think at some point, because of the unique threat that they see as Donald Trump, that they see him as a unique threat to all the things they fight for, he's proven to be this uniting force for the progressive coalition, where I've seen, you know, people who traditionally are uncomfortable with religion in those spaces be like, well, they were out there out front advocating for the same causes I was. That pastor, that priest, that imam was praying for the exact same cause that I do. So maybe I can team up with them this go round. And I've seen that shift happen a lot underneath the Trump era.
Yeah. Jack, this is a tough question, but I know you're up to the challenge. What do you say to people who criticize the moral activism of progressive faith leaders as purely partisan, as just the mirror image of conservatives who work to enshrine their values in civil laws and public policies?
And they clearly haven't spent much time with progressive religious activists. I mean, there, in the sense that there's always some, you know, exception. There, I'm sure there are activists who are deeply partisan. But I mean, like, it's telling that, you know, I mentioned this in the book, when Faith and Public Life, one of the core organizing units of the institutional religious left, was created in like the mid-2000s, you know, Podesta actually straight up told the head of that organization, Reverend Jennifer Butler, to stay away from the DNC, stay away from the Democratic Party, and not to get too close to those power structures. I mean, they were encouraged, even among those who we would consider institutional liberals, like John Podesta, to not attach themselves to this sort of, you know, partisan influence. And again, I think it comes from that sort of prophetic tradition. They don't want to attach themselves to power because they see any core element of power as something that can be used against them, against the people for whom they are advocating. Now, there are those who would criticize that on the other side as a lack of strategy, that the religious left can sometimes be too consumed with, you know, the prophetic witness and not as attuned to the value of, you know, of making sure that their activism can change laws, can get people elected who will pass the laws that they would want to see better the United States. But in terms of partisanship, I mean, I think that's something that, if anything, a lot of these religious left activists that I've interviewed see that as, if they are aligning with a party that is out of convenience, not out of loyalty, and to a fault, I would argue, at least that's the argument that many other activists say, is that, you know, religious activists are often the most willing to jump ship if the morals are not upheld by a politician. So I don't think that there's, and the left just doesn't work the same way as the right, because there is nothing on the left like the religious right. Irrespective of religion, there's nothing that's built with that sort of loyalty and kind of machine politics on the left. And so I think that it's true, both the religious left and the left in general, that it just doesn't work that way. And it'll be a while before I think anything does get built with that sort of top-down structure that we see having, you know, influenced American politics from the right for so many decades.
I'm going to ask you a question now that nobody else is going to ask you unless they're somewhere in my age range. How things have changed. I was thinking of that as I was reading your book. When I began my work with Interfaith Alliance in 1998, we could hardly get a good journalist to write about religion, and especially about religion and politics. Now, sharp reporters know that they have to write and talk about religion. In the news world, is this reality here to stay, or could you envision a time the public may not be so interested in religion or politics, or religion and politics? People who would have no interest in the marvelous book that you've written.
Well, I will say, I will commiserate in that when I first started covering the religious left, I would show up at some of these protests or some of these demonstrations, and I would be the only reporter in the room. And there's two ways of looking at that as a reporter. One is to conclude, I've picked something that isn't actually newsworthy and I'm wasting my time. And the other is the conclusion that I drew, which is that you're on to something that other people just aren't paying attention to. And I stuck with that, and I think it panned out to be the right call, which is that I found that these groups, these progressive religious groups, were influencing politics across the board. They just were going unrecognized. Now, to your bigger question, I at this point, fast forward to, you know, 2019, 2020, I'm, you know, trying to get these interviews with presidential candidates about their faith, and I'm being elbowed out by other reporters who are doing the same thing, that, you know, we started to see this surge of understanding that it's not just the religious right that's influencing politics, but that the faith of these candidates and the faith of those activists that that have been pushing for progressive causes for years now is influential. So I do think people are starting to get that. But I will say that we are and will continue to be for quite some time a religious country. Yes, the religiously unaffiliated are a growing group, but one, that group isn't uniformly a religious, as it were. They might not affiliate with a religious, but significant proportions of them still pray or still involve themselves with religious activities. And two, you know, it's just going to be decades and decades and decades before religion, you know, isn't one of the main driving forces of people's lives throughout the United States. And here's something to remember. The opening chapter of my book chronicles, you know, the passage of the Affordable Care Act and the influence of faith groups on that. And one of the key communities that that played a role in getting that through Congress were Catholics. And this kind of, there's this dialogue between Catholic nuns and Catholic bishops. And Catholics only make up 19 to 20 odd percent of the United States. And if that were to be reduced to all religious people, we're only 19 to 20 odd percent of the United States. And we're a long way from that. That's still a sizable impact on American politics. And so I don't see the reality of religion impacting our body politic going away anytime soon, if ever.
I perceive you as someone who does his work with real passion. When you're not writing for RNS, you're commenting on the same topics on social media, which I take as a sign that you love what you do. So I'd like to ask you, as we end this conversation, Jack, what's the best thing about reporting on religion and usually politics?
Wow, I've never been asked that. I deeply appreciate that question. I think, you know, one of the most amazing things about being a religion reporter is that it basically allows me to be an everything reporter, because religion touches on economics, it touches on culture, it touches on sports, and of course it touches on politics. And so you get to engage with people in this variety of spaces, whether they're on a football field or in Congress, and how faith impacts who they are. And so as a religion reporter, I really have appreciated the breadth of things that I get to look at in this country and in other countries when it comes to my reporting. But I'll also say, you know, coupled with that is this interesting duality that I've really appreciated, which is that when you're a religion reporter, you do and often do cover some of the most horrendous things. Religion is not always something that upholds the moral standards in some ways. And sometimes religion can be a part of really some of the worst things that humanity has ever done. And you have to cover those. But then in the same week, you'll cover faith communities being the first groups of people to help those in need and the first groups of people to be feeding the hungry. And, you know, as a reporter, it has always been this amazing experience to see how by covering religion and its impact on politics, I get to see some of the worst, but also some of the most amazing and impressive things that humanity has done and continues to do. It's left me very, you know, cynical in some days, but more often than not, pretty hopeful about what we can continue to be as a species, which in the midst of a pandemic has proven to be a helpful disposition. So I think that's what I've really appreciated about covering this topic.
Jack Jenkins is a prolific national reporter at Religion News Service. His long-awaited new book is titled American Prophets: The Religious Roots of Progressive Politics and the Ongoing Fight for the Soul of the Country. You can read an excerpt from the book headlined How a Rally for the Right in Charlottesville Emboldened a Resurgent Religious Left on the Religion News Service website, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Jack, I always marvel at how much you do with the same 24 hours each of us gets in a day. This is an insightful work that you've given us, and an inspiring one as well. Thank you, as always, for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, again, thank you so much for having me, and it's always a pleasure.